We are here with the artists to ask them several questions about their work and how they have put together this extraordinary Biennale. So maybe I can ask you some questions.
For sure, yeah.
You said you are totally exhausted.
It's a little bit tiring this last week especially has been intense.
As I said before, to me it appears like the most alive, most dynamic pavilion I have ever seen, especially the US pavilion. It consists altogether of 6 objects, but all objects, maybe 5 of them become alive as sportsmen or a particular person enters, then they reach sort of another level. I would like to know, how did this idea materialize and what it took to put this exhibition together?
Well, this exhibition was an enormous, I think it was probably the most ambitious project we ever made, I would say, because it involved so many different people, from fabricators to choreographers to composers to banks to gymnasts to athletes to, I mean, it was just, I don't know, so many different people that we needed to bring together to make these works happen. And in one sense, like, I think on Monday, before everything came to life, when I walked through the pavilion, it actually seemed very quiet and it seemed like a very sparse exhibition, but it's not at all. As soon as all of the live components happen, there's just so much going on in all of the projects. But nevertheless, they all took a lot of time. I would say each of them have been existing for many years, but they've come to like become the works that you see them today probably within the last year of actually like really intensely working on them for this particular occasion. But like, for example, the inside the organ piece that we have connected the ATM machine, that was a very challenging project, because we had to find an organ maker who could make for us a special organ that would be able to exist in that space. And we found this wonderful organ maker in Bonn, Germany, who has been making organs for the last 50 years, and they even didn't have their own foundry where they make their own metal to make their pipes. So it's really incredible craftsmen that we were working with there. And then we needed to find an electrical engineer that can make us make a connection between this physical instrument and then this electronic interface that would connect to the automatic teller machine. And then we needed to find a bank that was willing to let us do this project, and we had to deal with, like, you know, security questions about privacy and people, you know, private questions about their personal information and so on. And then we had to find a composer that we wanted to work with that could help us translate this electronic transaction into something that we felt had some kind of musical integrity to it, that it wasn't just a sort of silly, you know, instrument, but actually it was a new experimental form of making music that had musically something interesting to offer as far as a new experimental form of music making. So that project, for example, you know, involved at least about 25 people.
How long did it take?
About a year to do that. And likewise for all the works, they were all very complicated in that way.
What's the question?
She wanted to know about the process of making this building, like what was involved in making this exhibition to take place or happen.
Well, a lot of the our methodology of working is very much based on finding things in the world that we find interesting. Through intuition, we find that its meaning is something significant that we like. And they range from objects to matter to operations.
Materials, processes.
Sounds, gestures, things like that. It's pretty much from everything that we can find, you know, in the world in which we live. That somehow represents something that we find interesting and telling and significant.
About the time that we live in right now.
You know what I find really fascinating from the moment that I was introduced to your work, which was before 2004 in Guangzhou Biennale, when we worked together, is that very often I see you returning back to Island of Vecchia.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems to me that it plays some absolutely central role in your work.
Absolutely.
It's the nature, it's the individuals, it's the movement.
Yeah, yeah. It's the social-political history.
Social-political history, certain kind of deterioration. And as I was looking today at your performances, I thought, well, maybe the video is the beginning of all of your performances, because these performances in some way, am I right?
I would agree with that completely. And actually, I think our first attempts, or our first sort of interest in like live performance, or using the human body to activate some sort of sculptural assemblage that we sort of created. The first experiments that we did were certainly the films that we did. And in those pieces, like Returning a Sound, the one that you're referring to, where we had the trumpet attached to the muffler of the moped.
Yes. It's all here in this show.
Absolutely.
Right?
But in that case, and you're totally right, in that case, when we did that work, we felt that, okay, so we had that that sculptural hybrid, that object. And then the question was, well, who should be using it? And where should that, because a moped is not something that you should show in a gallery. In that particular work, it's something that needs to drive somewhere. So where is it going to drive? And so that's why that became a film, because to us, the appropriate space for that sculpture performance to unfold wasn't in the context of an art exhibition, but was in another location. So the only way for us to bring it back into a context to share was to film. And that was definitely the early approach that we took.
And in the in this particular Biennale, the performances that are going on, they will be going on throughout.
Right.
Are you going to be working with the same people, or are they changing?
We have a core group.
But you have yourself have never been involved in the performances, right? You always had somebody.
Because we're always interested in working with people who have a set of skills. So it's been, I guess we could say that the objects that we use, they have a particular predetermined function that somebody needs to be able to fulfill. And as we've been doing these works, what they need to do has become more and more skilled types of things. So we had like a piano player who needs to know how to play the piano very well to do the piece of Stop Your Prayer, Prepare. Or in this case, we needed gymnasts who needed to do a certain skill. So that's why we are not performing, because we need people who actually have an amazing amount of skills, and then our sculptures or our objects are in a way a proposition to have them relearn their skills, because in almost every case what we're asking these very skilled people to do is to sort of start over again and relearn what they do and try to find another way to do it because of the sort of problem that we set in front of them, like do a gymnastics routine but not on the balance beam but on a seat, or play the piano from inside backwards and inverted. So it's, but we need to start with people who have a very strong ability at what they do in order for them to then do it differently.
As you make your instruments, like piano that you had at MoMA or here, things, you always make them do something slightly different than what they are supposed to do.
Is
the title of the exhibition also with many meanings?
Absolutely.
Like that? Yeah, it's called Gloria.
Well, first of all, we like the fact that the title of the exhibition has a Hispanic or let's say Latin base to it. So we didn't use the English word glory, but we really became interested in Gloria. First of all, because it's you can think of it as gendering the pavilion. It's a woman's name, among other things.
Yes.
But also Gloria has existed as a sort of also signifier for so many different things over time. So we like the fact that it has this transversal quality to it, that, you know, there's all these different intersections with moments in history, with different types of enterprises, from like sports to nationalism to the military to all these different things. So Gloria as a concept has all these different cross sections. But then mostly we just felt that it was interesting representing the United States and being based in Puerto Rico to give the exhibition this name that had a ring to it that resonated more with the local context from where we work. The procession's almost gone.
We were talking about the title of the exhibition, Gloria.
Yeah.
It was fascinating, again, that in many ways it's similar to your work. You have a piano, but you give it a different meaning or different use.
Mm.
The same with the title, Gloria. Of course, you would think it's glorifying, but actually
it's not. No, that was definitely the intention.
And why did you particularly put the figure of the Gloria into, I mean, means obviously it's not a coffin, it's the...
A tanning bed.
Tanning, yes.
A sun bed.
Sun bed. Yeah. It's again with the imbued with an enormous amount of irony,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, for sure.
So, yeah, it's actually the... The statue is called Statue of Freedom or Arm Freedom.
As you notice, the woman has a shield and a sword, and it's just in and of itself an interesting. Well, you know, you're in Washington D.C. It's on top of the Capitol building,
we've seen it, I'm sure.
Yeah, and we found it as a. You know, the fact that freedom itself is freedom, but with arms. And so already the very symbol of freedom became filled, already kind of framed by this idea of the militarism associated with the idea of freedom, which I guess in some way is like these two dimensions in the United States of like freedom, but also of militarism.
What is
connected?
What does it feel like being in the U.S. Pavilion?
I mean, like I was saying early on, like we actually through time collect all these things that we find interesting, right? And from ethereal things to concrete matter and so on and so on and so. And so sometimes we think about the medium, you know, as something that we have inherited, but questions that one comes or deals with when we're asked, what is your medium, you know, since we actually have an interdisciplinary practice. And more has become sort of interesting to us to think of a glue or adhesive as our medium. By that I mean, that is what helps us link all these things that have nothing to do with each other.
Or seemingly don't have apparent connections, but then when you have them together, you do start to see very precise meanings and associations that emerge.
And so glue then becomes this sort of a space in which can be taken by context. So context can be a great glue. Mm-hmm. Through context we can think of like things that we have been interested in to put them together because the context becomes that adhesive. Etymology sometimes is that. Sometimes it's research. Sometimes it's just, you know, poetry. And so. So these have been something, in this particular case here, we have been wanting to do something with a tank, you know, and with a treadmill.
And the tank came from, am I correct, it came from...
From England.
From England,
yeah,
yes.
We could not buy an American tank.
No. So you couldn't buy U.S. tank?
No.
You could not buy U.S. tank at all.
We could buy a World War II
tank, but not a contemporary one. Not one that's actually engaged in battle right now.
But in Britain, you can buy a contemporary tank.
Yeah, this one is the Centurion tank, it's called. And it's still in use, actually. But it's also been, as most of these large arms are, the case is, they've been sold to many other countries. And they've been used
It's like a weapon, you know, it's manufactured somewhere by a company or a nation, and then they're sold, you know, to...
Which, strangely, ironically, was the main tank that was sold to Israel, and Israel has used it as, like, one of their main weapons, actually, in the last 20 years.
Really?
Yeah. The wars in Egypt.
And Lebanon, and...
Everywhere else, yeah.
Palestine, of course.
How did you come to design the furniture? Because that was another thing that fascinated me. I don't recall that you would actually, before design the furniture, or maybe I'm missing something. I have seen you working with instrument.
Well,
and I don't want to call it image.
They're not...
They're ready-made.
Yes, they are. They're actually the latest industrial design.
They're not ready-made. They're sculptures. They're business class.
Well, they're sculptures, but they're based on...
Object.
Right, but they're based on ready-made objects that exist in the world. So the design was not something that we imagined, but rather we took from reality. And basically what they are the two business class seats that are on the international airplanes of American Airlines and Delta Airlines.
Or U.S. Airlines.
U.S.-based airlines. So these are two different objects that two American-based airlines use to try to attract customers. And they especially put all of their advertising and their design into designing the business and first class seats because that's their way of branding their progressive ideas about what travel should be, what business should be, how you should use your time productively, what the experience of flight should be. And we found them very interesting because they are so differently shaped. Like the American Airlines seat, which is the one used for the men's performance, is very bulky and angular and sort of awkward. It kind of reminds me of like a Lazy Boy or something like that. It's very like fluffy, whereas the Delta seat is very futuristic looking and has these kind of sinuous designs and is using more like more like sort of the new forms of like computer programming that you have, like kind of blob architecture sort of sensibility to what, you know, an object, kind of like these chairs
and stuff like that.
So anyway, we found them as interesting kind of cultural anthropological objects that say something about, well, among other things, commodity fetishism, but also about, again, how a nation projects itself through their products that they try to sell to the world. So that's why we chose those two particular seats.
And also sort of strategies like isolation, you know, displacement are sort of things that make the objects look kind of abstract. You know, you have never seen an object like that because there's a seat before and after it.
Right, and
in
I
the
never
distance,
saw
you can never see
them either. We just sort of pass by them.
No, even people who have seats in them, they see them because, you know, you have a seat here, then you have one here and one here. So that sort of distance, that sort of framing of it is completely different. Also,
but we were thinking about them as these objects of desire, because it's always, you know, as we're part of this sort of global traveling society, the idea of the business class somehow represents this, you know, desire, space of desire, or, you know, contempt or whatever. But anyway, it has this sort of function, I guess.
So here you are, you know, you're creating work that is aesthetically challenging.
Yeah.
That is really pushing the borders, because it's also very performative,
mm-hmm.
and it's also very political.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think artists and art can have influence on politics?
You want to say something?
I think it's all about how you define politics. That's the first thing you need to define in a conversation in order for us to sort of, like, for it to make sense. There's so many different understandings of politics. There's governmental politics, non-governmental politics. There is sort of like, you know, how do you define it? It can be endless. The way we understand it and the way we use it in our work is things in the world, they have a particular form, you know? They're forming in a certain way. They have a certain use. And they're understood by a group of people collectively in a sort of a special, unique way. And that can be anything from a tank to a tanning bed to a passport to currency. As soon as you change, and representation has to do a lot with that. Representation in sort of the artistic sense, but also you can think of the political sense. How a group of people are represented by others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how, you know, a nation is represented by another nation. And so representation becomes a very key sort of central thing. As soon as you change the way an object looks, the way that object is used, the way that object is understood by others, there's a transformation that happens. And that in itself can be, we understand it, we personally, as a political act, as a way of transforming the way you understand and see something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, each person, that transformation, of course, in a different way. And it's unmeasurable. It can just go from just simply when you see that object again, think of it in a different way, to completely change the way you deal in terms of how you relate to that object and what that object represents.
Or to the things around
to
it.
To completely go into some sort of serious, so how do you act, and you know, the choices that you make in terms of voting and purchasing and so on and so.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference between art and politics is that politics needs to function. Politics needs to have one's particular function.
Well, governmental politics needs to be clear in terms of its end value, whereas art is allowed to be
endless.
As an open...
It doesn't
and,
have to end in one particular thing.
Space.
Just think of consciousness.
Yeah.
It's a thing of retrospection and kind of understanding in your own way what the work means and what does it mean for you, how to act in the world.
And also, I guess, another to me a really important dimension of politics is the question of power, of course, because politics is always linked to power. And Guillermo's like description about this idea of transforming the way one either sees something or the use of an object
or the representation,
of it is definitely
social terms.
On a fundamental level, is a transformation of the power relations too, because you unbind. If you're talking about glue again, you have things that are once stuck together, and you unbind those chains, and then you allow for a new possible combination to emerge. And that is, in and of itself, to me, the
we see the
political dimension
of art.
What you could do on art.
Tell me, what is there for you next? I mean, obviously, this is going to have a huge impact on the people that'll see it.
Mm.
I think it'll have also a huge impact on those a relationship between the object and performance, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It'll also have a huge impact on the fact that many of these objects have a strong political content.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So where are we moving next? What's going to happen next?
The next thing that we want to try to do is work with, assemblage, but without any objects. Assemblage, in a way, is a word that is a procedure is very useful for us, but at the same time, it's very limiting because it doesn't introduce things that we're also interested in, like, you know, the realm of and the history of gestures combined mm-hmm. with each other without any material concrete thing,
or the human body
in relationship to objects. And so the next thing that we want to do is just really work with gestures.
Gestures.
And just make an assemblage of gestures that lasts around 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. That is a combination between barricades, the way that people do barricades, mm-hmm. or seatings, or sort of, you know, they're connected through their arms, and a revolving door.
So still performative, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
completely.
Still performative. Yeah, we're still,
yeah. Do you think it's a period? It's a strong period now of performance art.
I think that. I think. Well, obviously it is. It's, and I think I'm partly happy to see that because I think it's allowing for kind of experimental forms of art making to be introduced into a
new zone-like setting, right?
Yeah, and it gives a different, dimension to what the experience of art can be. And also, I like the fact that it really demands or asks of the public their presence in a space to really be there in that time and space, and that's kind of an interesting thing to introduce in a time where everything seems to be moving so rapidly and without any kind of sense of the fixedness of the here and now.
Right.
So I think it kind of refocuses attention on that. At the same time, like everything in this world where everything is also based on a kind of consumption model, I can see that the idea of performance itself could get over-consumed by this same beast of this art machine that is the contemporary art world that we live in, and can exhaust people's sensibilities to the more nuanced and complex types of experiments that might be going on in the field of live performance.
Do you think, because as you said, it's very important for people to be there, to really experience mm-hmm. it, and of course this particular period will be fairly limited.
Yeah.
I mean, it's long enough, but it's still limited. Are you considering to film this and then have a documentation of some sort? No.
No.
Really?
No.
Really?
No. I never thought of that. No.
Well, we thought of that, and we don't want to do that.
And we decided we didn't want to do that. Exactly.
What's the reason?
Well, the reason is exactly what the reason why performance is interesting, because it has to do with time and it has to do with the here and now. That it loses that when you
turn it
mediate
into a presentation.
There's a mediation, mm-hmm. so you're seeing something that is happening in life. Mm-hmm. For example, in the case of the performances in the business class, see, the proximity that you have to the actual event, you will lose it if you be there.
Yeah.
And that actually, the shaking, the turbulence of the body, the sweat, the smell, the way that other people experience it, and you see these other people experiencing that. Your relationship to the whole space, it just completely changes.
Yeah, it does.
And that's what makes the work unique and special and powerful, affect.
And that's why early on when we made our first pieces, like Returning a Sound, we've been always very deliberate about that. So if you're making a piece that is performative in the sense of the performer needing to enact a gesture, but that needs to take place somewhere outside the museum and gallery context, then the right medium for it is a film. And so we kind of want to preserve the medium specificity of the performance. So like films like Returning a Sound under discussion.
We're going to bring the motorcycle and ride it out down
or,
the Giardini.
Or bring the boat in the canal of Venice. So those pieces
need to take
place there.
Or show the motorcycle in the exhibition.
Whereas these pieces are meant to be in a space like this, and they can endlessly be reperformed in that same type of setting. So we kind of think of these works more like close to like if we were a composer making a piece of music, that every time, you know, somebody else can do an interpretation of it in a live setting, and that's, you know, we create the structure and the format, and that that can happen over and over again. And that said, I think we also also the projects like the film pieces that we did, where we're still interested in the performative dimension, but sometimes also are attracted to the specificity of a particular location, which brings a very precise set of meaning to that performative gesture. And I'm sure in the future we'll do other films in that same spirit, like the ones that we've done in the past. past. Right.
Which was your first performance piece? Because I am familiar with the piano that was at MoMA.
I would consider our first performance piece really returning a sound, is what I'm trying to say.
That would be the first performance piece.
But, you know, it was a performance, but it ended up being a film, but it wasn't a documentation
in the sense of
it happening in a museum and you get this archive, but the film itself became...
Was a performance.
And it was the medium, the correct medium for that thing to be... That's the end. It wasn't even... It was partly whoever saw it in Vieques when they were driving around, but really the whole thing was intended for the medium of the film.
Media, yeah.
So we're very interested in medium specificity and trying to be faithful to those conditions.
Tell me how the two of you work together. I mean, you started working together about 1995, am I correct?
That's right. Well, we were both students, really. I mean, to say we were working together is sort of making us sound too serious. We were both just students at the time and, just began being interested in contemporary art and wanting to be part of this and found it like it's a really interesting... way to think about the world, you know, through art, and decided that as we just in a very natural way, we're learning about this together and becoming more interested in it, that it made sense just to always do it all together. That's how we've always worked.
See, well, thank you so much. You have been absolutely wonderful.
No, I know.